Hi and hello, Watch fans, and welcome to another edition of The Real-Time Show with me, your friendly neighbourhood watchmaker, and our friendly neighbourhood jeweller, Alon Ben-Joseph. We have just returned from Watches and Wonders, and we are putting ourselves back together after shattering ourselves into a thousand pieces over five manic days. Alon, how is it being back home in Amsterdam?
It's been good. I'm actually shattered into 500 pieces, and you are to 1,000 because I had to skip out early. But it feels like I've seen you last week. But on the other hand, it feels like decades ago. It was a blast. As usual, great fun, great energy. We have a lot of ground to cover. We want to keep this under 1 hour. So I'll jump in immediately by asking you, Rob, what are your takeaways? What vibe did you have? What, if you take a helicopter view, what was the atmosphere? What did you feel? What are the trends you saw?
Well, I'll tell you, a helicopter would be damn useful for getting around Geneva, because Watches and Wonders is no longer, or nor was it ever really, just about the Polexpo. So the Polexpo is the official center of activity. There are 54 maisons, or brands if you prefer, exhibiting there. And it is, as you would expect from a massive trade fair, very professional, very clean, a generic layout similar to what we had in Baselworld. It has made slight improvements to the layout. The press center is a little better and a little bit more developed, but it's just what it is. It's nothing hugely special. But of course, while all this is going on in Polexpo, we have the Beau Rivage, which is better known as the primary location of Geneva Watch Days, which will be held towards the end of August and start of September this year again. And then we have Head Genève, which is a school of art and design, which is hosting Time to Watches, the terribly named Time to Watches. Somebody needs to explain that to me. And then there's also the Iceberg, which is hosting the AHCI. So very, very high-end stuff like Mickey Alata, Kari Vutalan, and David Kandel, etc., etc., etc. So there's stuff going on everywhere, and that's not even counting the boutiques, which are gladly opening their doors to people who are going to be in town for one of the events. So a helicopter would be very useful. Yes, I would love that. I'm sure the Beau Rivage has a helipad somewhere, although I don't know where. What did I think about it? Well, I thought it was a bit quieter in Polexpo this year than it was last year. Did you feel the same?
I do feel exactly the same. I got a bit mixed up because we started on Monday, which is not an official day for technically nobody. You and I added that day because we knew I had to come back earlier to Amsterdam. But then it became a jam-packed day because I believe I did 63 meetings in 3 days. I believe you passed the 100 mark because I didn't even dare to look at your calendar in our shared file for the other days that I left. But so I got confused because on Monday we did the Beau Rivage mostly, and Tuesday is the official day when the Pal Expo opened. We were there on the dot, 9 a.m. So I said to myself, oh, probably people got caught up either at checking in, getting the badges, putting their bags away. But yeah, it was quiet. On Tuesday, I was back at Pal Expo again. Less busy. And then when you talk to people, you heard that there was less footfall indeed.
I mean, it was generally a quieter event in many ways as well, because most of the brands had subtle updates to either existing stuff or like an evolution, not revolution, as you like to say. It was very much that kind of fair. There weren't really any haymakers dropped by any brand. There was big news, of course, and there's lots of talking points, so we'll get to those in a moment. So we'll get to those in a moment, but there weren't really any individual standout pieces at Polexpo itself. Most of the fireworks, in my opinion, were found at the Beau Rivage. Do you think the Beau Rivage has somewhat upstaged the whole Watches and Wonders event?
It's funny that you said that, and you know who actually empowered them is Mr. Dufour, the CEO of Rolex, because he hardly gives interviews. He gave one or two for very major titles, Swiss mostly, and he called everyone exhibiting outside of Polexpo pirates. So piggy banking on the Watches and Wonders organization, he called them pirates. And the funny thing is, these pirates started running with this name, including our dear friend Marie, because I saw somewhere she published that the pirates had a successful fair. And yeah, it was alive, it was kicking, it was buzzing, it was casual, it was fun and innovative. You felt the vibe, which was lacking, I find, at Polexpo a bit. So yeah, I concur with you, Rob.
What do you think an event like Watches and Wonders, held in a place like Polexpo, organized by very conservative companies working together on something like this, what do you think they can do to inject a bit of vitality into it? Is it possible, or is it always going to be a little staid in comparison to the good piratey ship that we have sailing down near Lac Leman?
You know, I have been saying for years that I miss Baselworld, and the last 2 years I've been thinking these big, big egos need to get over themselves and freaking move back to Basel. Why? Because Messe Basel has the infrastructure and the square meters to host everyone. What they're doing right now is absurd. You need to be inclusive. I'm not talking about your workforce. I'm not talking about Me Too generation. It's all about working together. And you know what? Even if they are, he calls them pirates, Mr. Dufour, they're not pirates. This was always the case at Baselworld, and every fair you'll see, there is always like an ecosystem in waves outside of the epicenter of things. So I don't think Geneva has a big enough place to host everyone in one place. So if that's the case, and I'm ignorant on this topic because I didn't look what fairs and fairgrounds there are available in all of Switzerland, but they should work together. And you know, now this was the second year that we have this half mishmash of the old SIH age with the beautiful, neat, posh, high-end, one facade, and on the inside of every boot, you have your own world. Now you have this half Basel world, literally the old Rolex stand and Tudor stand, plus Patek and Chopard are lifted and then put bang, boom, in that new hole. And then this year we had four new brands that were on a higher level that you and I got lost every time and we couldn't find it. So we're Nomos and Norken and Raymond Weilwer and Bremont. So it's a bit of, they're literally all over the place. So I highly urge to everyone working in the industry, guys and girls, please work together. Because in the end, we're in it together, pirates or not.
I believe the Messe Basel is the biggest convention center in Switzerland. So there's nowhere better for it, really. But I don't know. I don't think that Baselworld had the same vibe, the same enthusiasm, like seeping out of its every pore that the Beau Rivage does. I wonder, is it just the Beau Rivage being such a sort of ornate and luxurious setting, or is it the furnishings? Everyone's on sofas, or some of the suites still have the bed in because you have to pay extra to have the bed removed. Is it literally that sort of softness of the environment that makes you feel comfortable and relaxed? Do you feel more like you're visiting friends because you're literally hanging out in their bedroom? Or what is it? Because what I lack from Watches and Wonders, and what I lacked similarly from Baselworld, was the intimacy, I guess. It was always so cold. What do you think? Can they do anything about it? Can they make it better?
Good question. So now that you're saying that, I'm listening to you, we often visit friends, so it's skewed. But if I dissect it, you're right. These old school fairs are very transactional. They're set for you there to give something, either money as a retailer or millimeters if you're a journalist that writes, or literally minutes of audio for us podcast journalists. In the hotel, they're usually the underdog brands. I think they're more casual anyways. You're right, because you have sofas and beds laying there, it makes it more relaxed. And some brands don't even rent the space. Take Seven Friday, for example, where we sat with Dan Niederer. He just takes a table in the cafe of the Beau Rivage and does his business there. That makes it very laid back. So I think you're right.
On the subject of Dan and others in the bar area of Beau Rivage, I'm pretty sure they have to pay for those spaces, you know, to occupy those spaces for the week. I think it's already in agreement with the hotel, because I was talking to Emmerich from Egide, and he said they wanted to book a suite. They'd had a suite in the past at Geneva Watch Days, definitely, and maybe even the watch week around Watches and Wonders. But he tried to book it maybe 2 months ago or 10 weeks ago, he said, and it was sold out. Like, they had no more space. There were 48 brands in Beau Rivage. And so you had guys like Amida and Egide and Seven Friday and even Renaud Tixier down in the bar and doing their business across the tables there, because there was literally nowhere else. And I don't think that came too cheap for them, but cheaper than a suite, that's for sure. I'm not sure of the exact amount for a suite, and I'm sure they vary because some are bigger than others, but I think it's about 15 grand for the week. And I think the displays in time to watches were about 10,000 for the week. I have no clue exactly what each brand pays for in the Plexpo, and that will vary massively because the sizes are hugely disparate. But, you know, just to give people an idea of what people are paying to just be there, just to show their stuff to the visitors.
So to respond to those tips, I didn't know that because I just assumed. But if they did pay rent for that tables, besides paying for the tab of ordering all the food and drinks for the guests like us, then they've got ripped off because the brands that rented the room or suite had a logo and navigation and where to get to them. But for me, it wasn't clear whom was renting a table or not at the bar. So that's maybe food for thought for Beau Rivage. Regarding pricing at the fairs, I have no idea. We do know it's not cheap at all.
Did you also like the meetings at the bar, though? I mean, did it affect your interpretation of the brand, or were you just as comfortable to sit down? I mean, I loved it, sitting down across the table from Dan, looking at the new watches, look at the incredible box that they come in. That was one of the highlights, but we can talk about that at length later, I suppose. But what did you feel about it? Did you think it was an appropriate space for a meeting like that?
If they are doing guerrilla style, it's less appropriate. If they did pay for it, it's very appropriate. For me, I honestly don't care because you know me, I love people. I love to talk to people. The busier, the better. You and I got caught on camera, actually. Well, I got caught twice and you and I together. Once, you and I made it to the national TV, the Swiss TV, and I posted that on my socials. What did I get back as feedback? Oh, the usual Alon gesture. So it's very confrontational to see yourself on camera. Because I speak with my hands, so it's maybe actually good that you and I do audio only and no video. And I got a message from my dear friend Michael Tay, the owner CEO of the Hourglass. He's like, Alon, I'm missing this year's show because his dear wife is expecting their second one. Hopefully it's there yet. And he says, I saw you on the recap of Watches and Wonders video one, so I had no idea they filmed me. So I went and I had to Google that, found myself. And you see me in there with all my gestures again. So in that bar, it's the perfect setting for me because it's vibrant. It's people walking in and out. We shared the table with our friends from Tourbillon Watch and the watch professor. So I've never actually met Carson in person. So that was great fun. So I love that synergy where everything comes together. So yeah, I love it.
So we're raving about Beau Rivage. I'm sure Dufour and Plexpo will be pretty annoyed to hear that we enjoyed sailing on the pirate ship a little
bit. Yeah, we're pirates now as well. Oh, pirates. No. Oh, no.
We always have been, I think. So talking about watches, so I found you in Beau Rivage. We'll start at the beginning and then we'll pick up the pace with some absolute highlights. Sniffing around, you had this day on Monday where you got into town a little bit before me and you were sort of wandering about, figuring out who you're going to go see, who we didn't have an official meeting with later in the week. And somehow we hadn't made a meeting with Bern, had we? And that's where we coalesced and we got to see the watches again and meet the people behind the brand again. And that's always fun because they're a vibrant couple. And that was a nice way to kick things off before we saw Dan at 7 Friday. And then we went and saw Carlo at Tutima. All very good stuff. No like mega new releases, like evolutions of the same concepts as we discussed before. I think 7 Friday's 3D model, it's called 3D, isn't it? It's actually hard to say. I always have to force myself to pronounce the TH on 3. So now having to forcibly drop it is a bit jarring, but that's cool as hell. The box, like I mentioned, is insane. It's all 3D printed, finished in a remarkable way using like the top-notch technologies available to the brand. It's this lattice work cube that has a big lock on the top and it folds out into many levels with the watch like carefully snuggled in the center. It's absolutely stunning work. And I think that concept is great. We saw some stuff that's coming, but it's heavily embargoed, so we can't talk about that. But it's very exciting to see 7 Friday really pushing the envelope with design and I think getting back to their roots a little more, because when they tried to evolve the original TV shape case concept, the models that were close but not really the same, it wasn't as successful. But this new direction, this is what I expect from them. And yeah, the price point is significantly higher, but I think that just adds value to the entry-level pieces. What did you think of that?
It's actually fun to see Dan again because we were the first retailer in the Netherlands for 7 Friday. So I know Dan for quite some time. We had him on the show. Fun interview. So if you haven't heard it, go back and find that episode. I don't know the number by heart right now. And it was great to see him. And that's what I love about fairs, seeing old friends, making new friends, hanging out and just talking about our passion all day long. Because our days were very long. We hardly slept 4 or 5 hours every night. You got me drunk only once. So kudos to you, Rob. Well done. Going back to Beau Rivage, we did indeed just stumble into Bern, which was fun. And that's the beauty of that hotel as well. Because the pivotal, the spine of that hotel are the staircases. Because you and I did over 20K steps, I think, every day. And you run into people on the staircase. And then you just jet in and out of suites. I start my day, which is a tradition. Every fair, I meet up with Pascal Rabessout. He's head of the FHH. So I caught up with him, got a vibe of what's happening in Switzerland. Because I had to leave earlier, I met up with Vahe, our dear friend, today the managing director of HYT. You had an appointment, so I went ahead of you. Then we had a lot of fun with Sexy Boy, Guillaume Lade. They rent a big space for all their brands, including this year Atelier Wen and for Lamari, that weren't there. Why? Because they didn't plan on starting on Monday. They wanted to start on the same day as Pal Expo. But because so many people were already in town, their PR agent, the best agent in the world, Marie, told them they need to rock up. And they rocked up and they did a lot of business. And she brought Swiss TV. That's why they caught us on camera. So that was a vibrant room. And you had Maison Alce. That was cool to discover. I read about them. They offer you a box set that you can build your own table clock. So it's fun to meet them. It's really about discovery during these fairs. And that's what I enjoyed the most. Afterwards, I jetted off to Bulgari. Did we discuss IKEAPOD already?
No, we haven't touched on IKEAPOD. That was another one.
I'm going too fast. Okay. All right. So I'm all over the place. Sorry, because Bulgari rented the most expensive suite, I believe, at Hotel Wilson. It may be in Geneva, but I think the La Reserve also has very expensive suites. So they rented the top level of Hotel Wilson, which they did as well for Geneva Watch Days. I met up with them there, saw the world record again. They broke another record. We caught up. We talked a bit about arranging visits for our dear TRTS community to come out and meet Bulgari and some other brands during Geneva Watch Days. So stay tuned. Subscribe to our community on WhatsApp if you want to be in the loop and hang out with us the end of this summer. So that was cool. I'm jumping back. So we went to IKEAPOD to meet CL Cole, the current owner, doing fun stuff. And the cool stuff is their newest novelty is the pod in automatic, full titanium with a new bracelet. And to my big surprise, our dear friend Adrian Buchmann, member of the TRTS network, actually designed that watch. So he's so discreet, he never breaks embargoes and tells secrets. So I was very happy to discover that watch because I love IKEAPOD and CL is a cool cat. We met up there with Carson, again, the watch professor. By the way, check out his website because he has daily quizzes on there. Very cool. We're now going to explore how we can incorporate him and the TRTS network a bit more to bring some gamification also to the network. And then TRTS network member Hans-Peter Piet, also guest on the show a few weeks ago, came to see us. So we hung out. And I guess, Rob, that enhances what you just said. It feels like hanging out with friends. I guess that's what we do, right? We meet up with people. People walk in and you just hang out. And that's fun. It's not so stiff.
No, not at all. It was very fluid, very easy. And you've mentioned some great brands in that spiel already. And I want to touch on one of them particularly to talk about one of my highlights. And that was HYT. So as you said, I had a sit down meeting with Ahe and the team later on in the week. And I was really, really impressed with the new T1. And we'd seen this model on renders before a couple of weeks ago. And I was like, okay, the reduction in size, you know, getting the case down to 45 millimeters, which doesn't sound like a small case, but because of the clever angles of, well, it's a lugless case, really, the way that the strap integrates into the side of this faceted case that sits very comfortably on the wrist, made it so much more wearable than the previous stuff. I am really impressed with the dials in real life. The finishing was beautiful. The strap change system, the quick change system, it's kind of like Hublot's sort of button release, but on the bottom of the watch, so it's very discreet, very hidden. It is absolutely brilliant. So I hope that this latest iteration of HYT, because the brand has obviously gone through some financial tumult in the past, and it has come out the other end in a revamped guise once already under Davide Cerato, and now under the leadership of Vahe. So it's very, very interesting to see how this brand continues to reinvent itself, all built around its truly innovative time-telling technology with those fluid-filled capillaries that indicate the passing hours like nothing else. So that was a real highlight for me. On Monday, we ended the evening not in the Grand Duke pub, as we normally do, my office, as I like to call it, where most of the good business takes place during the week, but actually having dinner with Ulysse Nardin. And I met Stephanie Krieger, the German PR agent for Ulysse Nardin, for the first time, despite having worked with her for years across many different publications and also with the Real Time show. It was like meeting an old friend, even though we had never met face to face. We had a lovely dinner. We met some very interesting people, some great social media, not even influencers, I would say, legends, maestros. Yeah, they were absolutely wonderful. They gave us some great insights into how they grow their channels and the techniques that they use. And many of them are data crunchers. They like to look at the stats and look at the figures and really, really create content tailored to what performs best, which sounds obvious. But of course, for those of us that aren't so deep into that side of the industry, it's all very interesting news. So that was fantastic. And while we're talking about Ulysse Nardin, although we didn't have our official meeting with Mathieu Haviland until the Tuesday at Polexpo, where we recorded the episode that went out last Sunday, along with the Ellie Bernheim episode from Raymond Weil, Ulysse Nardin probably won the show for me, especially Polexpo. I love the Freak. We all know it's a true icon of watchmaking. Its influence in the way that watches are designed and collected is arguably peerless in the modern era. It was an absolute revelation when it was released. And the new one, the Freak S Nomad, is heaven. It's smaller, it's compact, it has all of the things that you want from the Freak in terms of the aesthetics and the technology, but it has this additional German silver gear shade dial, which adds a level of traditional craft to the Freak that I don't expect of it, but now desperately adore and want it so, so badly. The case is beautiful as well. It has these tiny little flecks of gold running through a carbon case. The effect is stunning. The color is warm. The watch is wearable. There's not many of them, and they are 145,000 francs a piece. So probably won't be adding one to my collection, but I would love to. And that's the kind of feeling I want to have when I come away from a watch presentation. Just that excitement, I guess. I'm still excited about it now.
And you jumped because you and I split ways after Aikipot. So after Bulgari, I went to see François Moreau, the founder and owner of Reservoir. They were still building up their suite, but he was friendly enough to see me. We talked a bit, hung out. They showed me some novelties, cool stuff. I love what they do. And I afterwards went to see both Louis Erard and Raqueta. And because of that, Manuel Emsch also showed me the Colloquium. So they're going to expand away from just a friends and family launch, initial launch. So if you like that watch, stay tuned. A regular civilian piece is coming. And I did order one because I love what they do. He teamed up also with Amr, who is the horophile. So together with an architect, which I forgot his name, I apologize. And then I teamed up back with Rob at that dinner. It was a fun evening with cool journalists, PR agents, and not to forget the sixth generation of Hirsch straps. So Nicholas was there. So we had a lot of fun. Got some tips and tricks how to do more Instagram reels. So because of that inspiration, I did some more Instagram reels. So that was fun. Second day, Tuesday, Polexpo, opening of the Pal Expo, I started off at Oris. Loved that brand. Sat down with the team. Rolf came by. Also guest on the show. So if you missed that episode, make sure to catch that one. It's fun. Because Oris literally go their own way. That's their current or old slogan. They do their own thing. They are definitely about evolution or revolution. They revamped their most popular model, the Aquis. And I have to say, very, very well executed. It's like the 911. Every generation looks the same, but if you analyze it, it's a complete new car. That's what Oris did with the Aquis. It looks like an Aquis. It looks like an Oris, but it's a complete new watch. Case, bracelet, dimensions, and especially clasp. So they made one with a fine-tuning mechanism inside. You can get it still with Sellita and with their proprietary manufacturer, 400 caliber. So that was interesting. Then Rob and I met up back at Grand Seiko. And they do what they do best. Superb finishing, crazy dials, and wonderful movements. Automatic, hand-wound, spring drive, and quartz. Check our Instagram feeds as well. So you can find Rob at R-O-B-N-U-D-D-S or me at A-L-O-N-B-E-N-J-O-S-E-P-H. Obviously, our LinkedIn as well. We posted on LinkedIn and our socials a lot of wrist shots, a lot of videos. So if you want to have some visual support while listening to this episode, you can see the watches that we're actually talking about right now. From Grand Seiko, we went to Tudor. And although both Rolex and Tudor didn't launch that much, Tudor took Rob's wish of a Coke GMT and made it especially for Rob. So the highlight of the fair was the Black Bay 58 GMT steel watch, black and red bezel, gilt numbers in the bezel, aluminum, and the hands and numbers, or the indexes basically. So that was the highlight. That Instagram reel, by the way, Rob, hit for me 250,000 of views. I have no idea why. I did it super quick. The bracelet is way too loose on my wrist, so it's dancing everywhere. But apparently that was very popular. Then Tudor created the Black Bay 41 in a monochrome execution. Black bezel, black dial, no gilt. So fully steel. That's why it's monochrome. Metas upgrade this time, like the burgundy bezel last year. Again, 3-link or 5-link or rubber. Then the gold piece is not new. The gold Black Bay 58 with green bezel, green dial was there. You can now, as a third or second option actually, instead of leather or the textile strap, which comes standard with both for that watch, you can get a full gold version. Super cool because the bracelet is full satinated. I know only of two full gold watches on the market today that are fully satinated. It's the Bulgari Octofinissimo and the Black Bay 58 in full gold.
Let's talk about these Tudor releases. Did you like that GMT, that Coke GMT? I call it the Coke float because it's got the creamy lume and then the gilt numbers. It's a bit warmer than the traditional Rolex Coke, but what did you think of it, really? Were you impressed?
Deep sigh. I do not like gilt finish. So I have the black. I have actually all the Black Bay 58s besides the full gold one. I hardly rock the original black with gilt because I simply don't like gilt. I don't like two-tone. So I don't wear it. My favorite one is the blue one plus the sterling silver one. I didn't like it because I don't like the Black Bay Pro too thick. So the 58 became too thick. So it's a double negative for me. And I guess I was disappointed that Rolex didn't come back with the Coke and they kicked it to the sibling. So it was a trifecta of no-nos for me.
Yeah, I feel the same. I didn't like it in the end. I was really disappointed. I was hopeful. I actually like the idea of the colorway, like bringing the gilt in there to warm it up a little bit. at least in theory. But in practice, it just missed the mark. I would have rather just seen a clean, crisp Coke Tudor Black Bay 58. That would have been fine. I don't think I would have been compelled to buy it. I do want Rolex to bring back the Coke, and I'm still disappointed, surprised that they haven't done it. Weird that they did it with Tudor, knowing full well that everybody wants it from Rolex. Sometimes I feel they just do it just because they can. I don't see the sense in it anymore. Like, why withhold something that people want to buy it? Like, something so classic, something that's already been proofed in the market. It's not like me saying, oh, I want Rolex to do a purple and a pink bezel GMT because I think that would be cool. Because they could say, well, we've never done that, and we don't really do crazy stuff like that. But I'm asking for something that they have done in the past, something that the technology is more than capable of realizing in the modern form with the Cerachrome. So why not?
I'll tell you why. But before I do so, you know why they did gilt on the Tudor Coke Float, which is an amazing nickname. Kudos to you. Because the OG needs to be platinum finish inside. So silver, steel, whatever color you want to call it, for Rolex. So that's reserved for the Rolex. And it will come. And you know why they didn't launch it now? Because they want to cool down the market. So they made precious metal, precious metal, precious metal, 60 times precious metal. Day dates all around. Day date galore. Precious metal galore. And one GMT. And then, oh, you know what? We don't have enough references. So let's make a platinum 1908 with ice blue dial. Because all the platinum watches within Rolex have platinum dial, have ice blue dial. So they kept the Coke for you when the markets go down harder. That's a recession remedy. It's a vitamin to revive Rolex. So they're keeping it back.
That's a pretty good explanation. I'll give you that one. I like the sound of that. And I hope that it comes soon, but hope that the recession is not too devastating for the rest of the industry for it to actually see the light of day. What about this full gold Tudor Black Bay? It's about 30K, is that right? Around there?
Around 30K. I love it. They should have done it from the start. Good that they did it now. Imagine that one with a black bezel or a blue bezel. Oh my gosh. That would be a contestant for me.
Yeah, with a black or a blue, I could get on board with it a little easier. But it has this kind of drab green bezel and dial, and it's very very muted. It's very understated. And I'm not sure that I mean that in a positive way. I think the satin gold is cool. Yeah, I like it. Don't get me wrong. But I don't get the watch. Like, who buys a solid gold Tudor Black Bay?
I've sold a few. Not that many. The thing is, it's fun and cool on the green textile with the gold hardware. It's not bad on the brown alligator with a gold buckle. Makes it dressy. But suddenly on a full gold one, that becomes a serious watch. And it's a wad of cash. I guess that they'll make another dial combination or color combination soon. And I don't want to spend too much time on it because we only have 60 minutes. There's so much ground to cover. And you still didn't tell me your favorite. So to finish off Tudor, I did surprisingly thought the monochrome Black Bay 41 was a killer. It was good. They should have done it from day one. I mean, they had for over a decade a black version. But that black version had silver aluminum numbers in the bezel. But the indexes on the dials were gilt. So it was a mix. The Black Bay 58 is both gilt on the bezel and the dial. And this was fully modeled. Basically, baby sub. And oh my gosh, they did a good job. So that's good. And then they did a four thing. So a few sizes of the... They revived the rose a bit. That was a model that kind of was discontinued and for the Asian markets. Us European retailers couldn't even order that model. So they've revived that, God knows why, but probably because of the Asian demand. So that was Tudor. I don't know if you want to add something, but if you don't, let's do Rolex quickly.
I don't have much to say about it either, to be honest. I thought that the Black Bay was nice. Yeah, that was solid. That was decent. I think the gold one is silly, and I'd have no time for it whatsoever. When it comes to Rolex, it was just extremely dull. The new GMT with the black and grey bezel and the green GMT hand is just so underwhelming. I barely want to give it any time at all on air. And the abundance of precious metal models, I think this is slightly strategic from a pricing perspective. We said before the show started on our build-up show that we wanted to see brands add tangible value to existing products for customers with an eye on the price and making sure that they didn't go crazy. So basically, improve what you're already doing. Don't try and like blow the doors off. Just go sensible, go considerate, and give us more for our money. And I think that the precious metal thing is actually quite a smart way to do that in, okay, products that very few people can afford. But from a catalog perspective, it does seem to add a little bit more to each individual model without stretching the prices as far as they might have done during the boom times. Because during the pandemic, people were dropping just crazy bog standard watches and charging stupid amounts of money for them because people would buy anything in that period. And they kind of hamstrung themselves on certain model lines. Like I've said this about the IWC Ingenieur, which is one of my favorite new reissues of recent times. But I think at the price that it is, it's not as attractive as it should be if it were $7,000. I know it's a stupid thing to say because everyone says, well, yeah, of course, if things were cheaper, they'd be more attractive. But I just think that the product line would make more sense at a different price point. And that's what I mean with these precious metal models, where you could have gone even higher. They might have been tempted to go even higher with prices during the crazy days of the pandemic, but they've put them out at a level which is a bit more palatable and makes the rest of the collection make a bit more sense. The best brand for this, for giving us what we wanted, for me, was another brand we saw on Tuesday. It was the last brand we saw, and it was Alpina. And we had Oliver on last week, just before Watches and Wonders kicked off. And at that point, when we had that conversation, we'd seen all of the new stuff coming on images, but we hadn't seen any of it in real life. And the C-Strom, which was, I think, was certainly my favorite model from the renders, and I think you liked it as well, didn't you? It was up there for you, along with maybe the Alpina. It's incredible in real life. It's such a great watch. It's so well done. It's compact on the wrist. The execution is superb. The addition of the Yachtmaster style relief ceramic bezel is a masterstroke. It has completely taken that product line to a new level. Prices are still under 2,000 euros. It's a great watch from a heritage brand that really seems to have its head screwed on. What did you think about that?
We literally did like 7 p.m. meeting with our buddies, Niels Egerding and Oliver van Landschot Hubrecht. They are solid. We did have the honor to see a preview, and that proves how important both fairs and retailers are. You need to see the product in the hand, on the wrist. And yeah, the C-Strom is a killer. And Alpina is doing a great job. I mean, from the moment they did the Alpine Extreme or Alpiner Extreme, the brand is Alpina and the model is called Alpiner. And I like it. They created suddenly an identity and hero model. And whoever thought that a diver version of that could work. But I see a parallel with Zenith. They did the same with the Defy Skyline. Whoever thought that that would work as a dive model?
I don't think it does. I don't think it does.
I think it does.
That's my hot take.
Yeah. So, and that's where you and I differ, but I have a hardcore strong soft spot for Zenith. And I love the heritage pieces, but I didn't want to like a Skyline Defy diver. I'm like, what the F, really? But it works. And maybe both brands, Alpina and Zenith, caught me with their orange. And you were already buttering me up by wearing our Sherpa TRTS collab on an orange strap. That, A, I don't have my watch because my watch is still touring the world. And Martin, I'm still waiting for my orange strap. And I know you're listening, so hope you're making notes right now. But it looked so good. And then photographing these watches next to each other, I don't know, it did it for me. So both Zenith and Alpina made awesome dive watches.
Yeah, but the Zenith Diver is over 10K. It was more like 12,000. And I don't go to Zenith for a diver. Now, I know maybe I'm a little bit of a stick in the mud when it comes to this and what I want brands to do, but I want brands to really lean into what it is they're good at and not try and be everything at once. I don't think that that's what Zenith should be doing. I adore the movements from Zenith. I love the brand's history. I love its branding. But you got a dive watch at over 12K that looks like something that tumbled off a drawing board of Breitling in the early 2000s, which is not necessarily a bad thing. As an item, as a watch, as an object, it's cool, it's funky, it's fun. But I don't get it as a product in that catalog. So that's just my take. I think it was not what we needed.
No, well, okay, two things. First of all, you're always a stick in the mud. So FYI.
Lol.
Secondly, we went too fast. What about a freaking 320 grams dive watch in gold? What the F is that about?
Well, I don't like it either.
Well,
I'm being negative.
Yeah.
At least I'm consistent. I'm consistent.
You are. So I feel you. I hear you. And if Zenith didn't have the heritage piece, which is, I believe, the A3684 by heart, but could be I'm off with a number, then I would have said, dudes, what the hell are you doing in the Lochla? Are you making up shit right now? But they have the pedigree there because the original piece had orange in it. So I feel it. I like it. And you can be a stick and keep on sticking.
That particular Zenith you're talking about there, that one, the revival one, that was only 7,700 or something along those lines. I'm talking about, like, you know, the bigger ones with the blue and the black and the orange accents. Those ones were like wild. They were just so expensive. And I just, yeah. It's good that we have different opinions on these things. Let's put it that way. Before we run away from it too far, we want to touch on the Bulgari because you saw it in real life, the ultra, 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 ultra thin, world record breaking extravagance. What do you think of it?
Bonkers. It's amazing how they can keep going at it. And it was a bit confusing because Piaget also claimed another world record again. Bulgari took it back from Richard Mille. The world record of thinnest watch. And they used a Swiss coin to show that I was thinner. It's crazy. I salute them. I will never be, well, I hope I will one day, but probably won't be able to afford one. I believe it's something around 600,000 in whatever currency.
It doesn't matter at that point, does it? It doesn't matter.
It doesn't.
If it's yen, then it's pretty good. Yeah. But, you know, it's anything else.
Old Italian lira. But what they did, I loved, actually, and didn't get that much attention. They teamed up with Tadao Ando again, but focused on the ladies. And they made four serpentis to honor the four seasons of the year. And they made amazing marquetry-styled dials for the Serpente. And I actually, those were my favorite Bulgari novelties this year.
Yeah, I like them. I also like the new aluminium model with the faded green dial. Just, I've got a soft spot for those aluminiums. I think that they're kind of leaning somewhat towards the old Scuba line now, and I'm hoping that the Scuba's going to come back because that's one of my most missed models in the world of watches, the Bulgari Scuba. I really, really love it, and I want to get one. I've always got them on my watch list on Chrono 24, but I'm convinced Bulgari's building to a re-release of it in the near future. So I'm hoping that's coming, and maybe with an aluminium case as well. That would be interesting. When it comes to these ultra-thin watches, they're kind of like the Formula One of watchmaking, right? The technology that they're developing in order to break these world records and to make these statements and to blow everybody's minds is relevant to watchmaking en masse because it can be applied to more regular movements and more space can be made within a regular size case for additional complications. But as an object itself, I find these ultra, ultra, ultra thin watches a little bit ridiculous. Like, they're so thin, they're almost incomprehensible as a thing, as a working object. To look at it, you're like, well, that can't be real. Like, that there must be a point at which they can't go any further with this and these components still function. And I look at it from the side, and, you know, the bracelet is thicker than the watch, really. And it's like, well, how does that feel on the wrist? Does it feel comfortable? Or does it just feel absolutely bizarre? Have you worn one? Any of these ultra, ultra, ultra thin models for an extended period of time?
For an extensive time period, that's a bit long. But I did have the honor to wear the watch for half an hour of my 1 hour appointment. And what's confusing, there is a version that also uses platinum and two blue subdials, but I had the titanium version with a backplate made of tungsten carbide that prevents the flexing, because at a certain point, how thin can you go, right? And that's the problem with the Piaget Altiplano. You can't hold them because they bend and they flex and etc. So that's how they solved that problem at Bulgari with this world record, which is literally mind-bending. So going from Bulgari, Rob, I kind of want to do a quick intermezzo. I want to hear from you. Shotgun. Gun to your head. Your top three watches.
Top three watches. Well, okay. Ulysse Nadan, Freak S Nomad, HYT T1, and the one that pops into my head is the Alpina Seastrong, which is maybe a surprising choice for a fair that had so many heavy hitters there. But that was one that really impressed me. It stuck with me. I was, thrilled by it. It was what I wanted to see. It ticked every box of what I expected. If you allow me one from the one from the smaller brands though as well, I'll say the Doxa 200T. That was a special watch because that is just like the Seastrong. It takes all of the experience, all of the heritage, and it puts it in a package that is up to date in terms of sizing. Incredible value. The Doxa 200T is like 1,500 euros. And it comes in a wide range of colors. You've got the classic orange, the Shark Hunter, the Sea Rambler. So that's the black and the silver. And then you've got the Caribbean blue and the yellow. And there's this ocean emerald or sea emerald green. Very nice. And a special edition in a kind of pastel green with gold indexes. It's incredible. Like that price, I always wanted a Doxa 300T, but I didn't really want to pay what they're asking for it because there's a lot of other dive watches around there at that price point. But now the 200 is just a no-brainer. If you're a fan of dive watches, if you're a fan of a good solid daily wear watch and you want to spend under 2000, you can't go wrong with either the Doxa or the Alpina. So I'll put those two in there, both like cute affordable dive watches. They're in my number three slot, but the big ones for me are the HYT and the Ulysse Nadan. What about you?
Some people categorized it as Pal Expo favorites and then outside of Pal Expo, but you mixed it all, so I'm going to do the same. So for me, you know, I have a soft spot for IWC, but felt that ever since George Kern left, he set a trend of making it a fashionable watch brand instead of a technical watch brand. And I didn't like that move, and Christian continued that, but I do have to pay him credit. This year, he got me hooked again with the Eternal calendar. So the Portuguese Eternal calendar, not the perpetual, but the Eternal. They programmed it up until 3,999 because we have not decided yet if the year 4,000 is a leap year or not. And that blew my mind aesthetically, but especially technically. I'm not such a fan of all these Pantone storytelling things they have done and did this year again, but the number one spot goes to the Eternal calendar. Then, going from the one side of the spectrum of craziness, I'll go to not craziness in price, but definitely in concept and colors, although I'm not really allowed to call it the Super 31. Nomos, newbie at the fair at the Pal Expo, the Watches and Wonders, official exhibitor at the Watches and Wonders, because that's very confusing. A lot of brands say they are at Watches and Wonders, and those are the pirates that Dufour refers to, but they even brands that don't exhibit anywhere and say they were present at Watches and Wonders. So Nomos, Glashütte, literally, was one of the four new brands exhibiting at the fairgrounds, at the Pal Expo, at the official Watches and Wonders. No pirates. They hit a home run, 31 colors, cool, vibrant, crazy color combinations of the Tangente 38 date. I love it, and they take the second spot for me. And then third is for me, HYT. I knew what was coming, but seeing the watch in the metal on the wrist, I love it. And it's the first ever HYT where you don't see those pumps. I call them the hydromechanic pumps that push the liquid left and right. I've always loved HYT. I still do. and I'm happy they're still alive and kicking. And they pushed the price down, so it's still a lot of money, but easier to reach. And I was scared it was too big and too chunky, but really, really works well. I didn't want to love it. Unfortunately, I do. So congratulations, Vahe and HYT. And then some bonus awards. I won Hand Sin an award. I haven't seen them for donkey years. We had a cool, fun meeting with them and love what they do. So a little shout out to them. And then, you know that I got super excited listening to the episode, TRTS episode, with Beauregard, with Alexandre Beauregard. I couldn't unfortunately join the actual interview, so I listened to the episode as a civilian, as I do. I never listen to the episodes where I'm on the episode, but the ones that you or David do where I'm not at, I listen from A to Z. That dude is so passionate, it radiates through the airwaves. I've had the honor to meet him twice during the fair. Went to his stand as well. He created a watch at Vianney Halter, which I admire. Bonkers. Everything they do, bonkers. And really, really impressed me. So last year, I was impressed by Charles Zuber. Like, that was a curveball. This was a curveball for me. And then one more, and then I really will shut up at time to watch was as well Barron's. That really, really impressed me.
That's a good one. Well, since you had some bonus picks, I'm going to have some bonus picks. And also because I actually forgot my favorite watch. I didn't put it in my top three. So I did this really weird thing for Watch Gecko the other day. I wrote my top five watches from the fair. And then there was a collaboration article when we all had to say what our favorite watch was. And my favorite watch wasn't actually in my top five. And I justified it by saying, I think that the watches I picked for the top five were the best watches for the brand and what the industry needed in that moment. But my favorite watch, unfortunately, wasn't even the best watch for its brand. It was Chapek. Not exactly a spoiler. I loved the green meteorite. I didn't see it coming. Nobody did. We didn't know it was coming. It wasn't communicated. It's incredible in real life. It's so beautiful. I mean, I've got a green dialed Antarctique, obviously, but this is an even nicer green, if I do say so. And the reason why it wasn't on the top five is because the Mount Erebus solid gold Antarctique with the Lame finish dial was, I think, the most important watch for the brand because it set a nice ceiling of cost at around 55K for the Antarctique line. I think that it's a much better value watch than the titanium pieces that came last year around mid 30s, or the Sector one is 28, I think, and the regular, the Revelation is 35, 36, 37. I'm always about $2,000 off of Chapek prices, so forgive me. It's around that ballpark. But that gold one was amazing. The meteorite, I absolutely idolized that dial. I'm going to see if Chef A will make me one solid gold Antarctique with a green meteorite dial in for my birthday next year. I think he'll say no, but, you know, I'll ask him anyway. And the other honorable mention for me is also Nomos. I have to say, I love the Super 31 collection, as we call it. I have my top five colors, and I wonder if you do also, because I'd like to share them with the audience and see what they think. In no particular order, I would say it goes Chili, Tief Zegrau, Pop Orange, Ramba Zamba, is that what it's called, the red one, and Lakritza. What do you think? What were your favorites?
I don't even want to think about it because I wanted one. We were honored with one set because not all Nomos dealers in the world are eligible to get a set. It's sold out in a jiffy. So I don't even want to think about it because it's irrelevant. So I don't want to waste brain power on it and waste our listeners because there's so many that are so cool. So I have a question for you, actually, to go back to Chapek. I, unfortunately, didn't have time to visit the stand. I did see Xavier. We did a hug, quick chat in the hallways. I am dying to hear what you thought of the new models, the 38 versions, and those, I call them Tadao Ando-ish dials that are enamel finished. What's your verdict?
So this is the Promenade collection, right? So it was coming for a long time. I'm very glad that it stuck at 38 millimeters. I had a nice chat with Xavier on the bus back in some... In fact, we spent pretty much the entire evening together. He went for dinner with Monochrome and then to the GMT party, and then he posted up at the office at the Grand Duke, and we walked home together at about 3 a.m. So that was very nice. So on the bus back from the fair, we were chatting about the dimensions of the Promenade, and he asked me whether or not I thought it should have been 1.5 millimeters bigger, because apparently there was a phase when they went through, they were thinking about expanding the case out, and I was like, absolutely not. I think he nailed it. It's perfect. The proportions are just right. It wears very well. It's not pushed as a unisex model, but it clearly could be worn by men or women very easily. It's a nice addition to the line. The Gut Do, the blue drop dial with this incredible enamel pattern, is brought to life in the same way that they brought to life the vision of collective horology when they did their special edition with the shallow shores of the, you know, the sandy beach and the light blue and the yellow hand. It was done in the same way. So the dial is 3D, and then vitreous enamel is applied to it. It's fired, and then you get this incredible effect, this ripple stemming out from the sub-seconds, which is off-center. I think it's gorgeous, and I think that that one in particular is the winner, because there's two more that use a straight-line guilloche pattern on the dial, like a sort of Art Deco effect almost. And they're very nice, but next to the Godot, it's just not a contest, in my opinion. One is clearly better than the other. Although Xavier is very, very, very fond of the Deco ones, and I think that they will find some happy homes, but it's great. How do they develop this collection going forwards? Well, they want to focus on the sub-seconds dial as the center of the design, so there will be things radiating out from it or surrounding it in the future, and he has some ideas of different materials and different design techniques that he can bring to that to get the most out of this new case collection. But yeah, very glad to see it. I think it's a good evolution. Again, it's kind of like the original Kai de Berg, right? But smaller and more wearable and a bit more modern. I think it's a bit more what we needed from them right now. Otherwise, updates to the collection were superb. The Passage de Drake in purple was absolutely stunning. Yeah, big, big thumbs up for Chapek this year.
Very, very interesting to hear and to share. Let's go back into the flow of things that we've seen. I've seen a little glimpse of Favre Loeber, what it's going to be. So I'm actually excited to see how that develops. Met up with some retailers. It's always cool because you get a pulse of the industry globally. I was too late for Belarus. Rob, what did you see there?
Oh, you know what? A lot of it was embargoed. So unfortunately, I can't talk about the most exciting things. But they've got great stuff coming. All I can say is there are models in their upcoming release calendar that I would buy sooner than any other model in the current collection. So I think they're doing great stuff. There's a lot of titanium pieces on the way, really using the material in the way that it should be used. You know, very highly technical designs, very aeronautical inspired. I think that they are on a good track. Whatever they're having for breakfast, I want some, because it was good. It was enthusiastic. It was very exciting. So watch this space. I mean, they're good. They're doing good things.
Okay. So unless you want to discuss any other brands at PAL Expo, let's discuss the hot potato, the relaunch of Bremont by Davide Serrato. What did you think, Rob?
What did I think? I struggle with it. I like the old logo. I like the old wordmark. I like the old design. I thought that Bremont was very, very close to achieving the goal, the lofty goal that Nick and Charles had set out many years before. With the EANG 300 caliber, I thought they have a base now. If they can keep the prices a bit more in touch and really focus on refining the aesthetic for which they were known, they were going to have another period of dominance. I thought that it was about to happen. Instead, we got, yeah, it wasn't really a soft rebrand. It was kind of a very heavy-handed one. There's a new logo. It's called the Wayfinder logo. It looks like the Stone Island logo. There's no way to get away from that. It just does. It's supposed to be propellers over like a compass, but, you know, it's not what I think of when I think of Bremont. I know it's brand new. Of course, I'm going to get used to it, I'm sure, but I just don't like it as much. I don't think it's as elegant. The new word mark is, yeah, more action-oriented, I would say, rugged and tough, and that's what they want to do with the brand. They want to make it more of a tool watch brand. They're keeping in touch with the aviation side of things, but they really want to make it more about, you know, endurance and adventurers and people out in the wild wearing these rugged, indestructible watches. To that end, the new models are made of 904L steel, which they really, really tried to push hard as a positive thing. And I know Rolex uses 904L, and that's a big deal for Rolex, so on and so forth. But to be honest, I don't like it as much as 316L because there's more nickel in 904L, so it's harder for more people to wear. And there's actually, when you break down the tolerances of 316L and 904L, there's quite a lot of overlap. So like very good 316L can be better in all the meaningful ways than very bad 904L. At the end of the day, though, it's going to come down to what the cases actually look like and how they're finished. And what we were presented with was not really tight enough. The design is okay. I kind of like the idea of being inspired by old trench watches. That's cool. But the execution, it was loose. So I was looking at these watches and, you know, they sell it to you as, we're going to reposition the brand. Price point's coming down. Show us this watch and it's $2,500. And I think, oh, okay, that's pretty good. That's quite attractive. This is a good starting point. I pick up the watch, I look at the case, and you know I'm really, really finicky about finished transitions. So from brush to polished surfaces, like I like the line to be crisp, definite, laser straight. And it wasn't. It was a bit buttery, as I say, a bit blurry. And I was like, oh, okay, fine. Well, it's 2,500. I guess that's okay. And then I'm looking at the dial and there's a couple of dial variations. A black one has these massive Lumicast hour markers on, which are great. I love Lumicast hour markers. Big fan of those. And they're in this faux rad color, same as the hands. But the black of the dial actually comes through the hour markers. They're not quite thick enough, or they're not well enough backed. They should have been backed with like a reflective surface or something, like a foil or a white even, so that they really popped against the black of the dial, because that means that they're not actually the same color as the hands in real life. And I'm thinking, okay, maybe it's like, you know, a prototype, but I don't think so. We did do some exploratory questioning thereafter to see if we could work out whether these were actually the pieces that were going into stores, and we were adamantly told that they were. There's a white dial version of the same watch, which has the same faux rad numerals on the dial, but with no outline. So they kind of, they lose a lot of their impact. If they'd outlined them in black, which was quite common for a trench watch that's the source material, it would have been much, much more legible. Anyway, that line is fine. Then they roll out the power reserve, and I'm thinking, okay, well, the power reserve is probably going to be like 3K if we're going to stay in this new positioned price point, but it's actually more like 4K. And I'm thinking, okay, quickly getting back up into the realms of the original prices. Then the chronograph comes out. And I'm thinking, well, if the chronograph is here, that's got to be at least 5, surely. But I'm already like losing the thread, thinking, okay, I was expecting maybe 20 watches to all be under 4,500. I thought that was the goal. And very quickly, we exited that. Then the next piece comes out. Do you want to describe this one, Alon?
No, please do.
Okay, well, there's a rose gold chronograph, which is around 29,000, which was just like, okay, I'm losing this story. The final piece in this new sort of land-focused line was a DLC coat of titanium-cased Geosphere Tourbillon. And by this point, I was looking at the presenters, and I think they could sort of tell that I was a bit confused. And I couldn't work out if we were joking or not. So it's a tourbillon, a Bremont tourbillon. In this case, in this range, in this line, it's not like, you know, a fancy Hawking model or a Wright Flyer or anything like that. It's supposed to be the adventurer's watch. And it's got the Geosphere that Davida had a lot of success with at Mont Blanc right there on the top of the dial. But I don't get it. I don't get it. I don't get the cohesion of the brand. And then they showed us the new S300s. They were all in bright colors, like bright Kelly green and royal blue. And they look more like Ralph Lauren watches. And I mean, the entry-level Ralph Lauren watches than they did S300s, which, might I remind everybody, had recently had possibly the best time of their existence. The S300, I think it stumbled out of the gate, but then quickly found its feet. And we had like matte cases, nice reduced sizes, blacks and faux rads and subtle oranges. It was awesome. Sometimes you see these in the wild, they blow your mind. They're so much better on people's wrists than they look on the screen or in a catalog. They really are worth checking out. The old ones. The new ones, just goofy. They're cartoonish. And then they have the S500s, which are now made entirely from ceramic. There was a black model and a limited green model. And it was green ceramic case, green ceramic dial, green ceramic bezel. There's only, I think, 100 of them or something, thankfully. And apparently they've all been bought in by Bremont's retailers. But I will be very interested to see how quickly they sell out. Because this is tough. This is a tough, tough sell for me. That model in particular, these ceramic S500s, again, they're like 6,000-7,000. It's a lot of money. And I noticed this yesterday because I was just in my own head for a week and I didn't hear any external criticism about this range. Apparently, everybody's been piling on to Bremont for exactly the same reasons as I'm describing here. I haven't read any of the criticism. I haven't checked out the comments. I didn't want my own interpretation of what I saw to be colored by that, knowing from other parties that it's quite a common opinion to have. And some people don't like it when everybody just jumps on and says, oh, this is a bad move. This shouldn't have happened. Oh, the brand does this wrong. The brand does that wrong, blah, blah, blah. But when there's tangible reasons for it, when you can point to it, when there's evidence that's been in your hands and it isn't just secondhand hearsay, you've actually experienced it. And for me as well, as someone who was a Bremont watchmaker, only for a year in fairness, but I made a lot of those watches in the biggest period of that brand. It's 2015. It was absolutely flying. The majority of the Wright Flyer models I assembled. You know, that's probably why they don't work. No, I'm kidding. They're great watches. I love them. I did a really good job. But I mean, I know these watches intimately. I know Nick and Giles. They were my employers for a year. And they're nice boys. They really are. They had a great vision. They did wonderful stuff. They were very hands-on with the design. And now you'll notice a statement came out soon after, I would say, the criticism started to mount for this new repositioning of the brand. And Giles mentioned that it was, you know, tough to take a step back from Bremont and that, you know, these were the first watches that they hadn't designed. And, you know, you can read that statement however you want it, but it's quite clear that it's important for them at this point now, seeing what the response has been initially, to distance themselves from the watches in case they need to make a return to the fore and kind of pivot if this experiment fails. For Davida's sake, I'm hoping that it flies. I'm hoping that everybody loves it and he gets enough rope to really develop the collection and to turn the brand around entirely. But I am skeptical, and I'm skeptical for the reasons that I've mentioned. I don't want to pour fuel on a fire unnecessarily, but for me, that did not hit the mark. And it's a shame because I love Bremont, the brand. I love the people behind it. I love a lot of the people that work for the brand. I think they're great. And I think if there's any team that can sell this collection, it's probably that team. But yeah, it's in my opinion, going to be tough sledding. What do you think?
Poof, I'm happy you took the mic first. There's so much to say, and you've said a lot. I agree with almost everything. Bremont was one of the four new brands at Watches and Wonders. That created a lot of expectations. Davide coming on created a lot of expectations. Bill Ackman becoming majority shareholder, pumping a lot of money into it, created even more expectations. And then, in the build-up to this fair, Davide ramped up with a lot of media attention, stating he wants to champion the affordable tool watch segment of the watch industry. So that created even more expectations. So that you expect everything below 3K and you expect very commercial watches. I walk into the fair. We, by coincidence, took one of the two entrances, which was upstairs, coming in, bang, first booth, Bremont. Who's standing at the booth? Davide. Kisses, hugs, ta-ta-too, wrist check, boom, he has the Supernova on. I'm like, oh, wow. So the first thing I saw was the logo. I said to Davide in a joking way, I said, amazing, you're going to conquer the world like NATO, because the logo reminded me of NATO. And I didn't even say that with sarcasm. And then he showed the Supernova. I'm like, ooh, cushion cut. And it's the only cushion shape. So this is the only thing I said to him. And then he pulled out of his pocket of his jacket a black ceramic new Supermarine. And the first reaction, and everybody who knows me knows I speak my mind, I said, oh, you're going after Tag Heuer because you said it reminds you of the entry level Ralph Lauren. Me, it reminded of Aqua Racer, you see? And this is already dangerous because it becomes suddenly 12 in a dozen. That was first thing in the morning, and we had one of the last meetings at Bremont. Davide was unfortunately occupied, so he didn't join the meeting. We had his two lovely colleagues who did a terrific job. For me, I was disappointed. It didn't seem that commercial, so I was disappointed as a fan of Bremont because I've been loving the brand already for 13 years, been also retailing it. So I didn't see a model I wanted to buy, and I really want to support both Bremont and Davide. As a retailer, I didn't find it the cash cow they were saying it's going to be. But that being said, I don't want to be just negative. I liked the new design bracelet for the Terranova. He really made something new. I suspected that David had a writer's block. I don't think he had enough time. Although he's there for almost a year, I think he was under tremendous pressure to pivot the company, not just the brand, the whole company. So you see bits and pieces of genius, but it's not coherent. What I didn't like is, okay, they went full plunged on a new logo. Not really my vibe. Indeed, NATO, Stone Island, everybody's making jokes of a compass. I didn't like the font of the new one. I do understand why he moved away from the old logo, because the old logo were wings, were the propellers of a plane. And he wants to move away of being just a pilot's watch brand. What Nick and Giles did already, because they did make dive watches as well. So I understand he wanted to create a more versatile Gada watch-ish brand. But it's not only too similar to either Stone Island or NATO, whatever it reminds you of, but it's very prominent and big. I didn't like the font so much either, although you were in love with the old one. I wasn't stuck on the old one, but I expect more. And then he took heritage for the Terranova, so the cushion-shaped case, from Waltham U.S. trench war watches. And that's not really contemporary, is it? So I didn't understand what he's trying to do, because Bremont isn't the heritage brand because it's relatively new. And he's trying to mix old vibes with new. And there was a lot going on. I like the Lumacast cut numbers, but I don't like the font either. So I don't even want to go into the two wheel and the gold chronograph. It's really bonkers. Pricing, I hope they would step down. What surprised me, it seems they ditched the whole proprietary made ENG, I believe 300 calibers. When we asked you and I, they said it's in the pipeline for future launches. So let's hope that it wasn't a waste of investment. The Supermarine, I like the old ones better. There is a new bracelet. Looks a bit like the Terranova. When you inspect it, it's different. And then suddenly I saw a resemblance with the Rouleau by Breitling. So for me, the Supermarine became a Tag Heuer-ish case with a Breitling bracelet. So I'm not a fan.
It's difficult, right? We've overrun a little bit here, but let's just keep going because we owe it to Bremont to not just sort of make glib comments and just sort of say, oh yeah, we weren't very impressed. Like, there's a bigger conversation going on here about branding. And I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like this on this scale. I can't call to mind anything where a brand has like changed its logo, changed its wordmark, sort of established a new color scheme, this drab olive green, which is kind of cool, actually. I like that very much. And then completely pivoted stylistically. I suppose I'm all in favor of a repositioning of the products, but I don't know why you would abandon something that was very identifiably Bremont. So Bremont didn't really have a branding issue in my mind. It was recognizable. It had its triptych case design, which was really the best thing that the brand ever did. And they applied it to many of the models very successfully. And I can see ways to reimagine these pieces. I mean, the S300 was a reimagining. That was a newish watch that still stuck to the original codes. Why do you think Bremont has decided to do this within its own catalog? Because part of me thinks, what Davidas created there? Because we're criticizing, yeah, fair enough, because maybe it's not as coherent as we want it to be as a release, even separate from the existing catalog, but it's almost like a new brand. Like it's not just a sort of change of direction. It's like an entirely new brand within a brand. Like, couldn't they have done a second brand?
So super interesting, because I have this feeling that he was under tremendous pressure and had a writer's block, and or because he didn't finish the job, it seems. Why? Two model lines have the new logo, but the Martin Baker is there. Some of the old models are there. The MOD series are there, and they bear the old logo. So I do understand that you can't just throw away all the case backs and all the dials that you have and keep the models as is and just reprint dials with the new logo and the new font for the name and engrave new case backs. But it's a mishmash. And then I don't understand, why do you do only two families? Just maybe say, hey, I love everything that Bremont used to do. I'm slowly steering it into a new direction. Here is a glimpse of where I want to take the brand. New logo, new font, new style of watches. Here's the Terra Nova. And slowly we're going to evolve the brand. And here is my favorite slogan, evolution, no revolution. It seems he wanted to spark a revolution and he got stuck in the middle. And that post by Nick and Giles, which they didn't post, both of them, just one of the brothers co-signed a post 5 days after the start of the fair, which for me was a slap in the face towards Davide. It doesn't seem like they support what he's doing. It's a bit late and not very positive. I also wish both the brand and Davide a lot of luck. And maybe to round off this topic, because to answer your question, Rob, I don't know, but often you'll see CEOs trying to put their stamp on the brand and they always start with a logo and a font. It's not just the watches. And God knows what maybe Bill Ackman has a lot to say behind the scenes. We don't know. And maybe we should ask, because David did confirm to come on the show. So that's going to be a very fun interview. I wanted to end it on a positive and a funny anecdote. So, first day I'm back in our boutique. First customer I serve, literally 1 minute after we open. Consumer comes in. Hey, I've been at Watches and Wonders. Super exciting. I want to buy two watches. And by coincidence, you retail both. Nomos Super 31. Bremont Terra Nova 38. So go figure. As we say in Dutch, a beautiful watch is a sold watch. So let's hope that all the criticasters are wrong and that there is a market for the new generation of Terra Novas, because it is kind of new. So let's see.
Yeah, like I said, it's not so much a criticism of the watches or the, you know, the collection itself. It's the coherence and how it fits within the whole Bremont family. Because right now, if you go on Bremont's website, there's 248 watches in the catalog. And that's all the legacy stuff and that's all the new stuff. And that's a lot of pieces. There's a lot going on. I think that if Davide has time to really refine this concept and clear out a lot of the old stuff and maybe integrate some of the old design quirks of the old with the new more effectively in a subsequent range, then it could work. It could work. And, you know, they know what they're doing when it comes to making watches, and it's it obviously takes a bit of time to get everything humming along perfectly. But if he has that time, we could be looking back in 3 or 4 years' time saying, oh, yeah, well, that turned out to be the right thing for the brand to do. We will see. We will watch very keenly and hopefully get a chance to talk to Davide soon about it, because it would be really interesting to know what his design process was and what his longer-term vision for the brand is. And we'll leave it there. So listeners, please, if you do have any comments on any of the things we've discussed today, especially the large sort of chapter on Bremont at the end of the show there, then please get in touch via the usual channels. You can contact us on Instagram. Our dedicated TRTS handle is at therealtime.show. You can email either Alon, David, or me at Rob, Alon, or David at therealtime.show, or contact us via the contact form on the website, www.therealtime.show. We will be back soon with, I'm sure, more chat related to all of the watches that we saw at Watches and Wonders. But in the meantime, we'll be furnishing you with some new interviews and then some articles and analysis as usual. Until then, stay safe and keep on ticking.